Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Good Copy, Bad Copy. I'm Emily King, Radix's content marketing manager, and today I am joined by Fiona Campbell-Howes, Radix's founder and lead copywriter.
Hello.
And I'm joined by Radix's creative director, David Maguire.
That'll be me. It's lovely to be here.
We've got a new setup for this episode, which we may or may not be showing photos of and is incredibly confusing to me. But beyond that, in this episode, we're going to be discussing how and why B2B marketing content often goes unused by marketing and sales departments. Plus, we're going to have a B2B copy chat on this very subject on the 7th of June. If you wish to join us, there'll be details on the website post for this episode. So, let's, you know, how big an issue is unused content in B2B? Serious Decisions back in 2013 suggested that 60 to 70% of B2B marketing content doesn't get used. And if that wasn't bad enough, Michael Brenner once said that during a content audit when he was working at SAP, that they found that 60% of marketing content that had been created for a single product had never been used. That not scary enough for you? Okay, so the head of marketing operations for GE Healthcare last year during a Forrester Sales Enablement Forum said that 82% of the content they've created has never been used. But, you know, that's just, you know, a couple of examples. But how much could this affect the industry overall? Well, last year, and I hope I don't make a mess of pronouncing his name, but I probably am going to, Murunzi Hoto, SVP of Marketing for IDEO, estimated that in 2014, globally, of the $272 billion that was spent on B2B marketing, $50 billion worth of content was not used. I find this all rather scary. Why is there so much not being used? Fiona, David?
Well, it doesn't, you know, make us feel great as copywriters, does it, when you see stats like that? That, you know, because this is what we're doing all day in our job, is creating B2B marketing content. And when you hear that 60 to 70% of it doesn't get used, it doesn't make you feel brilliant. I know we'll probably come on to talk about this, but, you know, our definition of unused, I think in some of the stats that you mentioned, Emily, the definition of unused varies. So I think some people are talking about marketing's created the content, but sales isn't using it. And some people are talking about the content has been created and it's been published online, but nobody's looked at it. So effectively, it's been unused by the audience that it's been created for. But even so, I mean, you know, I've been working in B2B content writing, copywriting for a long time, and I've seen it firsthand that lots of the stuff that we produce doesn't get used. And when I suggested this as an idea for the podcast, I suddenly thought, God, that's not going to be a very good advert for Radix, is it? If we talk about how much of the stuff we write never gets used by anybody. But I think there are really valid reasons, or at least not valid reasons, but there are really interesting reasons why content doesn't get used. And, you know, I can think of a lot, but I don't know, David, from your point of view, have you had a similar experience? Did you see stuff not getting used that you've sweated blood and tears over writing?
Yes, I think there are always things that, you know, you put all your effort into and you really care about, and then it goes away to the client and you never see it again, and you can't show it to anybody, and you can't send them a link, and you can't send them a printout, because it's never happened. I mean, I've got to say, it's nothing like, you know, 60 to 70%. You know, it's less than 5% probably, but it just feels like a lot more. It feels, you know, because we can all think of it, you know, the odd example, because it feels significant to us. I mean, I think, you know, and those, that's the stuff that probably we can talk about most easily, because, you know, sales and marketing alignment issues, as copywriters we might have views on that, but really that's for sales and marketing to sort out, and that's for marketing to really listen to sales, or to introduce your copywriter to your salespeople, and not filter that conversation too much. Equally, you know, we might have things to say, you know, maybe another day, on how to make sure the content you publish actually gets read by your audience. Yeah. Because, you know, if you know, billions of dollars of content budget is getting eaten up by effectively producing wasted content. That's a problem. You know, I mean, the CMI, so, you know, 41% of content marketers say that budget is a challenge for them, but 54% say engagement is a challenge for them. And, you know, we can kind of help with the engagement stuff. And then hopefully by making sure when we deal with people that the content we produce is the content they really, really want, maybe we can help with the budget stuff too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this leads into, you know, some of the actual tangible reasons why content doesn't get used. And I think, you know, we as copywriters, we don't really see whether our clients tend to be in marketing, and we don't really see whether the content we create for marketing then gets used by their sales colleagues. So I think we can only really talk about when we create content and it doesn't get used by marketing people for whatever reason. So I think a really important part of that is sometimes the brief isn't good enough to create a piece of content that is going to be approved by everybody at the end client. So, you know, if you've got a good quality brief and the client knows what they want to achieve and they know who the audience is and they know what this piece of content needs to say, then there's a very high likelihood that you're going to produce something that everyone is happy with and gets approved. But if there's a kind of woolly brief and it's got kind of lost in translation in the various people that it's gone through before it gets to the writer, then there's a much higher chance that when you produce something, it's something that gets shelled rather than people deciding that they're going to put the effort in to, you know, correct this piece and rectify it and make it a piece that they can use. So I think a brief is definitely part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, and Kieran's just written a lovely blog post about this and the kind of horrible feeling of tap dancing and papering over stuff and kind of, you know, filling in yawning gaps in the brief where someone's given you two lines and gone, do something thought leadershipy around this subject. And you kind of go, you're the expert, I'm the writer. Yeah. And Kieran's has written a lovely blog about that, and hopefully we'll be able to link to it. And yeah, it is partly that thing, you know, if you don't give the writer the raw materials to work with, the results that you get might not be what you had in mind when you started.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that's one very good reason. And I think another one is we see a lot of marketers under a lot of pressure to create and produce a lot of content, but at the same time, they don't have a lot of time to review the content that gets created. So certain things get sort of pushed aside, especially if they're not for a specific event or for a specific, something they need to produce it by a specific date. So some things take a long time to get to the person for the person who needs to review it to get around to reviewing it. And in that time, things can change. So I have actually produced pieces of content for organisations that in the time it's taken somebody to actually review it, the organisation has been acquired. And so there is no further need for that piece of content.
That's the nice way of doing it. I mean, the typical one for me would be you send them a case study and they sit on the case study for 2 or 3 months. And in the meantime, they fall out with the client that the case study was about.
Quite a few times, yeah. And case studies are a really good case in point as well, because they rely on approval from third party, from the customer as well. And so every time that within the piece of content there's something that a third party needs to sign off or approve, then that can delay it, and that can delay it indefinitely. You know, we all know case studies where they don't even need to have fallen out with the customer, but it's just not on the customer's priority list to review this case study, and so it just never gets... It never gets approved, or it takes, you know, I've seen it take like a year or more to get approved.
Is there anything we can do about that as writers? I guess there's not. It's down to the marketing people finding time. I mean, there's no way that we can make it easier for them, or is there?
One of the things we've talked before about on this podcast is something that we call an editorial board model, which is where we have regular editorial calls with our clients to kind of review the content that we have created and talk about what worked and, you know, what's not working, come up with new content ideas and then look at what we're going to produce in future. And that's generally a kind of regular fortnightly or monthly call. And if you're having that kind of regular session with the client, then they probably get bored of you just bringing up the same blog post every time. Oh, what's happening with that blog post? Or, you know, what's happening with that white paper? And if you can kind of keep that regular kind of slot where you're talking about the content, and that there's much more likelihood that they're going to look at it and review it and get back to you with feedback.
With the editorial board, where you have more than one contact at the client company often, do you then find that within that you know which of those people will be most responsive and will get back to you with their feedback most quickly, so you can kind of begin to gravitate the work to them or get someone who's likely to respond to give it a first check, even if the final check has to be the really time pressured person?
We do find that they tend on the call. If you're talking about a piece of content, you know, you'll agree between you on the call who's going to review that and who's going to, you know, who has the time to look at it. So if it's not the person that would normally be looking at it, you can agree that somebody else is going to look at it and move it forward that way. Another reason that type of model is good for producing content that'll get used is that those types of editorial board call quite often have a salesperson on them. They quite often have a partnering person on them. And so kind of the ideas of content that are discussed on the call are talked about with the customer in mind. So these people know what customers need and they know what they need in terms of sales enablement and partner enablement. So when you're coming up with ideas like that with those types of people on the call as well, then it's more likely to be used not just by marketing but by sales as well.
And you just kind of get this stage, don't you, sometimes with it might be in the approval process or it might be somewhere else in the chain, because if copy is one of a number of moving parts in a project, so say it's web development, you know, or it's a video, or it's a brochure and you need various bits of design and pictures to come in from different places and different things, there are various things where a project can just lose momentum. Yeah. And grind to a halt, where it's, again, it's kind of no fault of the writer.
Yeah.
It's just that the content has, you know, has just gone into a project that stalls sometimes.
Yeah, and when things like that happen, it can often be the case that the client's strategy changes, or their plan changes, or their thinking changes. We see that quite a lot, you know. Or their budget changes. But even, you know, with some of the software companies that we work with, very fast moving and in a very fast moving marketplace, and their thinking moves on. And so, you know, if you take too long to get, I don't know, an ebook or a white paper approved, by the time they come to, you know, really look at it, their thinking has changed, so it's no longer relevant. So it has to come out in a timely fashion as well. And I think another really interesting and important thing is that not every client has editing and reviewing skills. I mean, these are marketers, and you know, some marketers are very good at reviewing content and providing constructive criticism and constructive feedback. Other marketers have skills in completely other areas of marketing, and so, you know, this can be a problem. They don't really know how to tell us how to make the piece of content better, and so quite often they sit on it, or, you know, they don't want to feedback to us, and so it just sort of gets shelved again.
Is that something where, as writers, we can somehow find ways to, you know, to ask them the right questions to help them put that stuff into words, to kind of tease that out from? I mean, all of these things are above and beyond the job, but we want people to get value out of the stuff that we're writing, you know, both from our own sense of pride and so that they'll get a good result and come and spend a load more money on brilliant marketing content.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is a case of, like, just getting them on a call or in a meeting and asking the right questions about, you know, what is not working for you in this piece of content. Because often it can be to turn out to be something quite specific that's quite easy to fix. And another thing that I find works really well is, you know, when we're creating a longer piece of content, we'll do an outline for it first. that says, you know, this is what we're creating, this is the audience we're creating it for, these are the objectives of the piece, these are the key messages we're going to bring into the piece, this is the tone of voice we're going to use. And, you know, this is what we're going to say, roughly speaking, section by section. So, I mean, that takes, I don't know what, 3 or 4 hours to put together. But, you know, when that goes back to the client and they say, oh, you know, maybe that's not quite right what we're saying in that section, let's change that. And then you can get agreement on the outline, you're much more likely to get sign-off on the final piece than if you just went straight into something without having had that kind of check-in with them first. Mm. So that works really well.
Is there also the possibility that, certainly for some in-house marketers, that their teams are so small that they don't have anyone around to help actually push content out, at least when it comes to digital content? So, like, blog posts.
I think this is definitely the case. We've created content for clients where they're changing their website, for example, but the changing of the website is taking a long time. In the meantime, we're creating content that that they don't want to put on the old website, but we're waiting for the new website, but by the time the new website goes live, the content has gone out of date. So there's that. But I also think, you know, it does take time and resource to post the content, but also decide how and where it's going to be posted and how and where it's going to be promoted. And, yeah, sometimes smaller teams don't have that resource.
Should some of that stuff not be done ideally before the content is commissioned? You know, shouldn't you? You'd hope that people would have a rough idea of what they're going to do with the thing that you're making before you make it.
Yeah, and this all comes down to, Emily might know the stat, I don't, about how many marketers have got a documented content marketing strategy.
It's only about 30% of B2B content marketers have a documented content strategy, and about 40 to 43% have a verbal content strategy. And Content Marketing Institute is very firm on the fact that a verbal one is not good enough.
Yeah, so this is, I think this is a really key thing as well. A lot of this is not planned and does not form part of a documented strategy.
And there's a risk of random acts of content happening.
Or not happening. Yeah. And I think, you know, coming back to our editorial board, that's another good aspect of it, is that there is a calendar that goes with it, you know, this whole model. So your content is planned and it's mapped against, I don't know, your key theme areas or your key audiences. And so you can see that, you know, we've planned content for these audiences and these areas and it fits in with our strategy and what we want to say. It's all coming back to the editorial board, isn't it? I think the fact that a lot of people have no plan or have no strategy is a definite part of it.
Can I be controversial and say that in some cases, I think that if content is not all content is being used, in some senses, it might be a healthy sign that you're taking enough risks. Because at some stages, I don't want to say you don't want to waste vast tranches of time and budget and various other things, but somebody has to be, whether it's the writer, whether it's the marketer, somebody has to be often pushing an organization beyond what it's done before into an area where some people within the organization might be uncomfortable, and there are battles to fight there. And I think that part of the reason that this idea of content certainly not being published is particularly dear to our hearts as writers is that often it's the things that don't get used are the things that we care about or that we got invested in writing because we took a risk or because we were aware that the marketer briefing us was taking a risk, was going out there, was doing something new, something that hadn't been tried before. Mm. And occasionally, unfortunately, with any organisation, those things are going to get squashed sometimes. Yeah. You know, I can think of things that I've put forward that didn't get used.
Do you want to share any examples?
I'm trying to work out how much there was a particular. I'm thinking of, for example, a particular advert, mm-hmm. that I wrote, and the The company name was one letter away from an expletive. And I just found a way of including the company name in a nice way that was complimentary about them. But if you were flicking through the magazine, you would stop and read it and go, what on earth is this? You've got their attention and you're in. And it was something where I still maintain it was the right thing for them to do, but they were quite sensitive about them, you know, because it was a family business, it was a family name, and they were a German family and they couldn't understand why this would be funny in English, and no, it's just offensive. No, there's a nuance to it, yeah, but you can't convince them of that. And fair enough, but I still think it was right for me to suggest that headline, because I think the headline would have been right for them to do. It was a risky thing to do, and I kind of sent it with a backup in my mind because I knew that it might come back. But I still think it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I think this happens quite a lot, that you will get a client or a marketer who wants to take risks and the rest of the organisation isn't sure, and so it's kind of 50-50 chance whether the piece of content gets through or not. I mean, I know I've worked on content projects where what we've come up with has been so far away from what the organisation has done up to that point that, you know, we thought, they're never going to use this. And they have, and then, you know, eventually the feedback came back that, you know, this ebook was the best performing piece of content they'd ever done, but it was just so out on a limb from everything else that they'd done that you do kind of wonder, should they have done that, or, you know, is that actually sort of diluting their sort of brand tone and brand voice and brand perception, but at the same time it performed really well.
Our brand is built upon many generations of dullness.
And then, I remember a project that you and I worked on, Emily, a video project. And this was risky because this was a video for use worldwide.
Yeah.
But the brief was to make it funny. And so we scripted it and it got approved, and it was a fairly British sort of humour.
It was two videos, though. Yeah. And you wrote the first one and I wrote the second one.
Yeah, and yours got approved. But they both got made. This was the interesting thing. It went a long way. You know, the whole thing got made and produced. And I think they both even went up on YouTube.
Mine was the only one that stayed up, though.
And I think the client felt that the one that I'd written, the comedy, wasn't going to work with some other nationality. So it came down again. So that's a very good example of taking a risk, but also it's a good example of how it's risky to try to use comedy
in humour and content,
especially if it's outside of one country.
Yeah, it doesn't tend to translate so well across national boundaries.
Unless it's at a certain lowest common denominator level. Sorry,
I can't imagine, like, because slapstick is about one of the few things that you'll find examples of. I mean, because if you consider the slapstick of early American sort of silent film comedy, that's there. And then you've got stuff like in Italy, obviously, Commedia dell'arte, which is slapstick, essentially. And obviously, that's something that translates in terms of comedy, but that's physical humour. I can't imagine many B2B brands having something where physical humour is a good thing. Physical comedy.
Well, I suppose, but there's that kind of comedy of sort of awkwardness and stuff about it. And I think that, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, in the UK, Rowan Atkinson is still arguably most famous as Blackadder. Around the world, he's Mr. Bean.
And
that's a thing that I can't quite get my head around, to be perfectly.
I'm sure poor Rowan Atkinson can't either. He's probably quite disappointed about that.
I'm sure he looks at his bank statements and cries every day.
There's another thing, though, in terms of, like, trying to prevent content, I suppose, from never getting used. If there's a chance it could take a while to get anywhere because of approval processes and reviews and stuff, is that obviously other sort of marketers and strategists talk about making evergreen content. But then I feel like there's a limit to how evergreen you can make content, particularly if it's maybe product-based, because obviously it depends on how long you're selling that product for. Or if you actually, in the case of like a lot of how software's developed now with sort of agile methods and that, like what you've written about the features for what a piece of software does 1 year, or maybe even less than a year or 9 months down the line, the software could be doing something completely different, and that product page that you might have written is now out of date anyway.
Yeah, or the just the business issues change. So, you know, the problem that you were solving 2 years ago is not the problem that people have got now. And so any content that you created around it then, it's no longer relevant. So, yeah, I agree. Content isn't really evergreen. And I don't trust content that doesn't have dates on it, blog posts that don't have
dates. Best before date.
It's particularly bad if they quote a whole load of stats and don't kind of have a year near them either.
I know. It's like you just don't know whether this is still relevant or not.
And the thing is that often, if you know, if it's something where you're looking at the real specifics of how you use something or a business issue that's drawing on real current research, it's the very thing that dates it is the thing that makes it great content. It's the thing that makes it, you know, useful and good. It isn't to say that, you know, there aren't things that will hold true forever, but for a long time. But some of the stuff that, you know, the really specific, useful stuff often is the stuff that changes. And that's just,
well, yeah, it is how it is. Something to compare and contrast with, if, you know, if you've got dates and stuff. So if you're researching and you're sort of putting content together, and at least the content that you're referencing has got dates on it, you can compare and contrast with, this was what people were thinking a few years ago, but now...
Yeah. You started up making useful marketing content. You ended up creating a historical document for the archaeologists when they go mining through the data centres.
Was it the great big web archives that... I love looking through that sometimes just to find like how company pages have changed.
There's my band in 1997. Hello.
So I think if we were going to sum up, not to say that we've gone off the point.
We wandered far from the subject.
I guess, you know, if there was one thing that each of us could do to make sure that the content that we write always gets used, what would it be? Emily?
I'm a bad person to ask about this because we pretty much use 99% of the content that we produce.
That's true. Emily doesn't have a problem.
That makes you an excellent person to talk about it. What do you do?
I talk to people about what we're trying to do, and I have a written content strategy for everything that Radix does. So I always try to check that stuff's kind of fitting in with it, so that it has a place in what we're trying to achieve. With our, you know, not just like business results and that, but what we're trying to say as a company about issues related to us and our audience.
So you'd think this podcast was all spontaneous, but it's actually planned with military precision.
Well, we don't. There's only a couple of bits that are scripted, you know.
That's what it says here.
It says general banter.
That's my name. Hi, I'm General Banter.
David, what can you do to make sure your content always gets used?
I don't know, you know, necessarily that it all should always get used, but I think the thing that maybe we need to do is to be aware of where content, the thing that you're doing, might be problematic later. Try and anticipate those hurdles in advance. You know, if the concept is risky, then maybe go to an outline first, maybe go to a draft, maybe get some kind of pre-approvals. If it's something that's very long, then again, map out the structure and get some agreement on that. If it's a thing that has many levels of you know, of clearance and of approvals, then let's get something in the diary so that we know I'll get this to you on them. You get so everyone's got a schedule, you know. So at least, you know, see it. You know, do what you can to see it coming, and work out which bits are probably going to be fine, and where things might get rough later.
Okay, so for Emily, it's sticking to a content strategy, and David, it's like taking a phased approach so that everyone's still on board with it at every phase of the project.
Yeah. Or knowing when you might need to do that, planning ahead.
Yeah. And I think mine would be to just make sure you've got that regular dialogue with the client when you've got a regular time that you're sitting there with them in person or on the phone to just go through all of the content that you've got with them for approval or planned, to just make sure it's all on track.
Because when you've got a client, it's so much better when you know them well enough that they can give you a brief and you can go, really? Are you sure? Are you sure? Really sure this is what you want? And push back. And that does depend on your, you know, on having a strong client relationship.
Okay, well, that is all we've got time for in this episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy. You can follow Radix on Twitter at radix.com, and you'll find our website at radix-communications.com. We can also sign up for a monthly email for latest copywriting tips and insights.